Welcome once again to the New York Jazz Workshop podcast, Jazz Brothers and Sisters. I'm your host, CJ Shern. I'm very pleased to offer you today an interview I did with 2011 NEA Jazz Master, tenor and soprano saxophone and flute giant, David Liebman. Over the course of his 50-year career, Liebman has played with Miles Davis, Elvin Jones, John Scofield, Richie Bayrock, McCoy Tyner, John McLaughlin, and many others. Liebman is also a phenomenal jazz educator, having founded the International Association of the Schools of Jazz in 1989, and he's the artist in residence at the Manhattan School of Music currently, as well as guest lecturer at the University of Toronto and Berklee School of Music. I spoke with Liebman on his way to a gig at New York City's Smoke via telephone with his band Expansions, who released an excellent album last year on the Wailing City Sound label entitled The Puzzle. On July 25th through the 27th, Mr. Liebman will be teaching a jazz-intensive saxophone course at the New York Jazz Workshop at their Michiko Studios location near Times Square in New York City. I hope you enjoy my interview with Dave Liebman.
You're doing this intensive at the New York Jazz Workshop in July, I believe.
Yes.
And how did you hook up with Mark Ocello and Mark Momas? Was it through Vic Juris, who played in your band, who's the faculty over there?
No, I think it's Vic met him through me. Mark was a student many years ago, and I know him for quite a while as a student first, and attending my workshop and so forth, you know. So we go way back.
How was the opportunity presented for you to do this workshop this summer?
If I'd like to take part in what they're doing, and I always do when I can teach, I do. And the fact that it's right in Midtown Manhattan is nice. And I know Mark, you know, he's been doing this now for a while, and it's quite an organized thing, and I'm glad to be part of it. Great player.
What are some of the concepts that you're going to cover with this intensive?
I know when I get there what the level is. I look, you know, I tell them, it depends on the level. But one thing I do for sure is the whole process of transcribing solos, why you do them, how you do them, how to get the most out of it, not just as an exercise, but as it really is a way of thinking. That's definitely going to be something I cover, and some things on maybe rhythm and melody, and the saxophone players will do saxophone. It depends on who the participants will be.
You just mentioned the saxophone solo transcribing. What solos do you feel are important for musicians to transcribe to help their learning?
Well, any kind of Dexter Gordon to start with, Sonny Stitt, Wynton Kelly's right hand, Hank Mobley, of course Charlie Parker, obviously. You know, all the guys who really laid down the rules and really get a strong foundation of rhythm and harmony. That's where we start, and I make that a big point in what I teach. And, you know, private students, if students have studied with me for years, it's mandated they do this, especially the feeling and the nuance and all the time rhythm things that go into the field, because you can't learn that from a book. You can only get that by imitating somebody who does it, and then eventually it becomes melded into your own way of being.
You know, Dexter Gordon and Hank Mobley, I think it's so great that you mentioned those names, because when you listen to them, they both have such a relaxed, fluid way of phrasing, and it's so, you know, like even just as a listener, it's very comfortable to listen to, and you just can pick up so much.
Yep, you got it. That's right.
Particularly because they're both influenced by Lester Young so much, too. So
that's right.
That's a big component.
Absolutely. Very good analysis.
For you, what makes a great teacher?
Somebody that leaves a student with hopefully some inspiration to do the work, but more important, a way to reinforce what you say. In other words, you present material, you have an hour or 2 hours or 2 years or whatever. The main thing is that you leave the student with a way of being able to reinforce it, because they're not going to be with you all the time. So it's the responsibility of the teacher to be able to say, okay, here's what I showed you, here's how you get it together. Here's what you do for this amount of time, or, you know, to begin, and once that's accomplished, then so forth and so on. And it's really the responsibility of being very clear about the material, not just about the beauty and the magic and all that. We understand that. But how do you get from, you know, A to B? And that's very important, you know.
And what are some ways that you recommend that they become clear about the material, as you just said?
Well, first of all, they got to listen, which is, you know, an art that's kind of gone down quite a bit in the last several years. Take notes of what's important. And most of all, ask questions if they don't understand. And then they ask the, you know, right questions, the teacher should be able to pinpoint what exactly what that particular student is asking about. So it's a two-way street. Student has to be interested, number one. Number two, ask to clean things up. Be sure they leave the room with an idea of what they have to do. If they didn't do that, then they didn't do their job.
What about getting students, because sometimes when people first start listening to jazz, they're so interested in what's going on now, and then sometimes they're not always interested in the history of the music. So how do you get students excited about the history of this music? Because I think the history of this music is so important.
Well, you need a foundation, and you got to walk before you run. And I make that very clear to students who come to me. If they don't want to do that, I'm not a salesman. I'm not trying to convince them that they should look back. But they're supposed to know that to be well-grounded, they have to understand what came before. And if they don't, then they just miss out, and there's a hole in their playing that somebody like me could tell pretty quickly that they didn't do a certain amount of work. So it's really on their, it's their job to do it. If they, you know, to forget about who's popular and what's going on today, that comes later. First thing is the letter came yesterday.
Right, because the history does definitely inform the present and also sometimes the future.
Absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, that actually makes me think, too. You did a speech, I believe, last year called Seeing the Light, where you talked about epiphanies,
yes.
Not only as your, not only your life as a musician, but also personally your battle that you had with polio as a child. And one of the things that you mentioned in that was the epiphany that you heard John Coltrane at Birdland in 1962, and that just sort of set things in motion. And you also had mentioned the Count Basie band, too. Now,
well, that was I had seen them initially at Birdland. That's prior to the Coltrane thing. That's you know, that was only just marking that particular event. The point of this whole talk is that something happens to you in your life. It's you might not recognize when it happens. And it could be, you know, from a musician, obviously music, but it could be something else personal. It could be something in the family, something that happens to the whole environment. Something happens that if you seize the opportunity and look further, you can learn something from it and possibly even set the course of the events of your life, as it did for me with Coltrane. But the main thing is to be aware of the possibilities of things occurring that you probably have already experienced and being able to just really think about it. Just taking life for granted that things happen and not looking into it, that's okay. But if you're looking to, you know, be inspired and have something that's a pivotal event in your life, it's probably something that already happened to you. And it's a matter of, like, exploring it, defining it, and then reinforcing it.
You recently worked with one of my mentors. You played with Mike Carbone on Bill Carter and the Presby Bop Quintet. And, you know, I'm a jazz writer, and I've been into jazz ever since I was a kid. I've been so fortunate to have parents who raised me on jazz. And I've always had an interest in it, and I've known Mike Carbone since I was 10 years old.
That's great.
Yeah, I was his teaching assistant, the Jazz and American Music course at Binghamton University, and he had told me one time, man, you got to get out of Binghamton, because he was like, you know, there's really nothing here. And at the time, I didn't really take too much stock in what he meant, but that was really, you talk about epiphanies, that was mine, because all these years later, I've been writing for the New York Jazz Workshop for 3 years now, and, you know, I moved to the Hudson River Valley again, which is where I grew up, and it's really, I mean, that was really such an epiphany for me, because it just totally changed the course of my life so much, and being able to speak to greats such as yourself has just been absolutely amazing and such a learning experience.
Well, you did the right thing, Lester.
Yeah.
Sure. You gotta go where there are people interested in what you're interested in, so you're not alone, you have support, you have inspiration from your fellow peers. And that's why you have to go to where there's action. If you want to study business, you got to go to London, Frankfurt, New York. If you want to study acting, you go to Los Angeles. I mean, it's very clear what you have to do.
Right. And you had also mentioned, too, about how you had studied things like law and history.
Yes, I majored in history. Yeah, in college, I was a history major. And the law thing was just sometime in my midlife, I thought about maybe dropping music for a while and taking up law. But the history was my major in school. At those times in the 60s, there was really no jazz program in the New York area to study this. So yeah, I had to do something else, and I enjoyed history, and I still do. Got a lot out of it.
Yeah, and in 1989, you were the founder and artistic director now of the International Association of Schools of Jazz.
Right,
and,
that's right.
And also, you became an NEA Jazz Master in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
You've been teaching at the Manhattan School of Music, and you're also a guest lecturer at the University of Toronto and Berklee School of Music. Now, what was very, very interesting was I did an interview several weeks ago with the great David Fusinski, and mm-hmm. he said that all of the playing situations that he had gave him concepts for his own playing. So do you feel that all of the playing experiences that you've had, like with Elvin Jones and Miles Davis and everyone, sort of has given you concepts for your own playing?
Definitely. That's the reason, that's the reason you want to have a mentor around who knows more. Because you look up and you see something you didn't realize, and especially if you're able to be on the stage with that person, that makes a big difference. So, of course, that affects you. And then what further affects you is musicians from younger musicians and musicians in my case, so many musicians from Europe that I play with over the years. Everything you do goes into the biggest soup. It's all seasoning. And it all comes out to be some combination of styles and of idioms and of experiences that become you. But it's based on everything you put in there, and that's your interaction with both peers, mentors, and students. So several different levels of relationships.
Yeah, and you really have one of the most, I think, identifiable sounds of any tenor or soprano player out there. I mean, you hear your soprano, and you know it's you. You hear your tenor, you know it's you.
Yeah,
and
we work on that.
Yeah, I think one of the big issues that's in this field as a writer is that oftentimes writers like to get stuck in a particular period of a musician's life for a certain period of time, and they don't really want to move forward. Like, for example, I love the Elvin Jones Live at the Lighthouse records.
Right.
But, that was, 40-something years ago, and that's not necessarily a snapshot of where you're at now. You grew a lot since then.
Yeah.
So
you got that right, CJ.
Yeah, so what...
I know what you're saying. I mean, the point is, everybody remembers the first splash you make, because that's when you are new and you're impressing whoever is listening and so forth. But most of the time, they don't ever think after that. They don't really pay attention to what you're doing. And it's difficult because you have to keep reinventing yourself in private, so to say, because it's not necessarily noticed except for somebody like you. You're saying exactly what what I would say. It's like, that's 40 years ago, and I've changed, and I've done other things and so forth. But believe me, I still get most of my questions are about Miles Davis and Elvin Jones, because that's when I first came on the scene and when I was so-called hot and so forth, and, associated with the legends of jazz. And, of course, there's nothing, you can't go through that more than one time. So I'm grateful when somebody somebody like you points out, the obvious, which is, you know, 40 years is a long time to be doing something and to try to keep it creative and so and growing. I mean, I'm in the car now with two of the guys from Expansions. We're going to Smoke. We're playing three nights. I mean, this band, to me, is, you know, one of the best bands I've ever had, and it's exciting. The music is different. I'm learning playing with these guys. Three of them are, like, half my age. I'm enjoying it, you know, so it's good when a writer should know that there's more half to the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, the Expansions album is just really, really wonderful, and the group of players that you have on the album, like Matt Mislucian.
That's right. Matt's right in back of me.
Oh, wow.
He's right. He's sitting, Tony's sitting, Tony's driving, Matt's in back of me. We play at 7 o'clock at Smoke tonight.
Oh, great.
Tony Marino's been around since the beginning of time.
Yeah, I saw him.
He's got a beard that is greater than fucking St. Nicholas, man.
Yeah, man. I've seen him. I saw him like maybe 10 or 11 years ago.
10 or 11 years ago. That's it.
And,
when he was 110.
Yeah. And he had the same beard back then as he does now.
Then, that's right. He's had that beard since he's 6 years old, man.
Yeah, Tony Marino, man. And the thing that always, you know, the thing that I always noticed about him was how visceral the experience is when you watch him play, because his head is all swirling around.
His head is swirling like a fucking yo-yo. That's right. His neck is about to be split off from his body at some point. He's putting more, he said more yes and no's than anybody in the world.
Yeah. Oh, man, that's great. But actually, you know, it's so funny that you mentioned your current band now, because another one of my mentors, who's a trumpet player named Jerry Bachman, he's a phenomenal trumpet player and educator.
Mm-hmm.
He heard you guys play in a duo at WVIA.
And Tony.
Bobby Yavey.
Bobby Yavey and me, yeah.
Yeah. And he wanted to know how much of what you started was like the source material, and how much did you branch off from the source material and made it?
I'd have to see, you know, it depends on the material. I mean, I think that what he, if he heard us as a duo at VIA, then it was when we were doing this classical thing, adapting Debussy and Schubert and Chopin for to our styles. I think that's what we were doing. And in that case, Bobby did most of the arrangements, and we played the melodies, and then we improvised. I mean, in jazz, usually the written music is about 10 to 20% of what you present.
Right.
And, the majority is improvisation. I mean, some people, in some situations, there's a lot of written music. I've had occasions where I've written much more, and, of course, occasions when I've had to read much more with other bands. But to me, the essence of the jazz is, you know, spontaneous improvising with some kind of kernel of, you know, direction. I mean, are we going to play all for one note? We play just free? Well, playing free is also a setting, you know, so it depends on the particular situation you're in. And, you know, my 40, 50 years have been really very eclectic. I mean, if you know my stuff, I go from left to right pretty quickly. So
it
keeps me, you know, it keeps me interested and keeps me inspired. And it keeps me as fresh as I can be by surrounding myself with different styles, and in this case, new musicians, as this band is now.
Oh, yeah, and it's always thrilling, too. Free improvisation, I think, is one of the most exhilarating aspects of jazz.
And that's the point.
And I, you know, I got into a big argument over at the Pat Metheny Yahoo mailing list about free improvisation, because there were people who were saying that free improvisation is all noise and it's not structure and all these other things. And myself and another writer were trying to impart to these people that free jazz isn't just chaos. There's a total logic and structure to it.
Well, it depends on who it is, and experienced musicians. For example, I yesterday was visiting with Ellery Eskelin, my partner in a group called Different But the Same. That's me, Ellery, Tony, and Jim Black. And, you know, we're just reviewing a new record that will be released later in the year on Pat Hut, where we did complete improvisation for the whole record. With guys like that, there's plenty of form and plenty of reference points. Free jazz can be an excuse for chaos, but in the hands of those who know about it, it's really another means of another view of improvising in the jazz idiom. It's just another substyle, just like world music is, or fusion, or you know, 20th century stuff I do with Bayrak, you know. This is just other aspects, and free is just another thing to do. It's like, let's play that way for a minute, you know?
Yeah, and it's so interesting, too, that you brought up the point that jazz is 10 or 20% of what the written material is 10 or 20% of the process. Because I heard a statement from someone yesterday who said that the defining feature of jazz was, quote-unquote, the time signature and the composition. And that, yeah, that's part of it, but that's kind of taking a very narrow viewpoint and eliminating so much of what makes jazz jazz, like the improvisation and the individuality and all these other factors.
There are a lot of misconceptions about this music, and a lot of people have no idea what they're talking about. So I don't take it seriously when I hear people say something like that, because they don't know what they're talking about.
My special thanks goes out to Dave Liebman for this very insightful interview. If you would like more information on Mr. Liebman, please go to davidliebman.com. If you would like to pick up his band Expansions and their album, The Puzzle, you may do so at all major outlets. And get more information about the album at WailingCitySound.com. Mr. Liebman will be teaching at the New York Jazz Workshop Summer Intensive from July 25th to July 27th. For more information on that, you can go to NewYorkJazzWorkshop.com. For the New York Jazz Workshop podcast, I'm CJ Shern. Peace, love, groove, and keep swinging, everybody.